You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, it's another subject that's new to the show, demonology. We often think of demonology based primarily in the parameters of what we have been told by pop culture, religious dogma, and televisual bias. Joining me to pull down the walls of what we are supposed to believe is Nathan Gillis. Nathan is an author, lecturer, and religious demonologist, and is here to challenge why we believe what we are told in regards to demonology. Nathan found himself drawn into the world of darkness when encountering a ghost whilst on a house viewing with his parents, but he began to question why we were not adapting to the hauntings, and primarily the role of demonic possession. Why was religion not adapting to these demons? Why were demons still appearing? Where do they come from? And why do they seem to be so religiously ignorant? It was these questions that led Nathan to take a very different view on what demons actually are and how we need to deal with these entities. Thank you to Nathan for joining me today to discuss demonology, and maybe you might need the light on for this particular episode. Anyway, so let's deal with the elephant in the room. As some of you may notice, my voice seems to be a bit different. For anybody that follows the show on social media, you may be aware that I ended up in hospital last week with a severe blood infection, which caused my throat to essentially close up to the point that I could not eat or drink for almost 3 days and had to be rushed in for emergency treatment. Thankfully, I received some fabulous care and treatment at my local NHS hospital here in Sheffield, and I am making a full recovery. And as the voice can tell you, it was a little bit tough and a little bit scary. So thank you for anybody that sent me some kind words. It really does mean a lot. I'm taking it steady. I don't know how long this huskiness will stay, but we will see what we will see. Okay. Anyway, enough of me. Don't forget, I need your ghost stories for an upcoming show as well. So if you've got any spooky encounters you wish to share with me, don't forget, I need your ghost stories for the upcoming Halloween show. So if you have any spooky encounters you wish to share with me and the listeners, anonymously or otherwise, please drop me a line entitling your email ghost story to mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. Our Patreon is now live with bonus content, early releases of the regular show, articles and monthly prizes for everyone who signs up through the show notes for a flat fee of $4 a month, which is an absolute bargain. Our latest episode features returning guest Stu Neville, covering alien autopsies, fairies, Bigfoot, Helen Duncan, the race for space, and much more. So make sure you click on the link in the show notes. Don't forget, you can also get some merchandise through our Redbubble Mysteries and Monsters shop, and the link's also in this week's show notes. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter as usual. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can email us at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com with any feedback, guest suggestions, or if you'd like to appear on the show. As always, the artwork by my wonderful brother Dean Bestel. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Right, let's go find some demons and let my husky voice take a rest as we join Nathaniel Gillis, demonologist. Today, I am joined by religious demonologist Nathan Gillis. Nathan's experiences as a child led him on a journey of discovery and changes that took him to a place he never anticipated. Nathan is here to redefine our concepts of hauntings and high strangeness. Nathan, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing very good. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Nathan, I will try not to insult your career and your choice of lifestyle in regards to this. My concept of demonology is essentially probably being framed by the parameters of religion over the last 2,000 years, probably, if not longer. What I find interesting and intriguing about your take on the situation is that you feel that the ancient knowledge and ways that we viewed them at the beginning of modern civilization, shall we call it, has mm-hmm. sort of sent us down the wrong path.
True. That's correct.
So what was the sort of catalyst for you as a child that sort of opened your eyes up? Because you grew up in a religious family. So it would be interesting to see how your interpretation differs from perhaps what people would expect.
Correct. I grew up in a haunted house.
Mm-hmm.
And I came face to face to a full-bodied apparition. I mean, as early as the open house before we purchased it, it was just literally my dad was showing the family what we were going to buy, what we were about to move into within a month.
Mm.
And he let me by the hand, took me into what soon would be my room.
Mm.
And he said, hang out in here for a little bit, figure out where you're going to put your bed and your gaming system. He said, Mom and I will be out talking to the realtor.
Yeah.
And so that was me. You know, I'm opening up the closets, checking everything out, and realized I didn't like the carpet. The painting was ugly on the wall. And just kind of, you know, working that little imagination I had. But I do remember something that was a profound experience for me. It was immediate. As soon as I walked into the room, I was met with a stench. Now, I know you recently had Dr. Barry Taff on the program. He's a hero of mine.
Same here.
And Dr. Taff would call it the decomposing or rotting organic matter.
Mm.
And so, you know, that was my first experience with it. And it met me as soon as I walked through the door into that room.
Mm.
But I was drawn also to the bed. Can't tell you why to this day, but I just knelt down underneath the bed and I pulled the blanket flap up. And lo and behold, I was staring directly into the face of a little girl. She was pale, beautiful little girl, beautiful. She looked like a princess, honestly.
Hmm.
And she was in a period, like an antiquated white linen dress.
Hmm.
And I'm staring right at her face. Just that's how quick it happened. I opened up the flap and right there she was.
Hmm.
And I watched as she had pushed herself up against the wall on the other side of me. And so I put the flap down. I didn't say a word. I was just like, okay. I did not just see that, you know.
And
I'm trying to figure out where to place her. Is she a, you know, is she a friend of the family? Is she a member of the family? Is it a child that belongs to the family? Does she live around here and it's an open house? You know, I didn't know what to think.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until after we were driving home in the car and I asked my parents. I said, you know, this is what I saw. Who is she? Is she a child in the family? Why, and if she is, why did her family forget about her? And my father just kind of smirked and looked at my mom and said, son, there's no children there. The house was owned by an elderly couple. They passed away and their adult children are selling the property.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was after that we moved in and I encountered a very violent, malevolent haunting that has left an impact on my life and really has drove me into this research.
Yeah. It's remarkable, I think, Nathan, when we often talk, because similar to yourself, my experience as a young child wasn't as malevolent as yourself. I too grew up in a haunted house and a converted vicarage as well. To boot.
Wow.
from the mid 18th century over here, which is, you know, a thousand years ago when you compare it to houses in the States, I would imagine. But
right. Well, no doubt, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's very interesting when I dove into your sort of origin story, as it were, that this seems to have been the line in the sand that you suddenly took that step past, and after that your life was never the same again.
Oh yeah, it was never the same again, because there were certain ways that I had learned how to cope with this presence in the home. I mean, there were nights when I would try to sleep early on within the first year of moving in. I would go to bed at night and I would hear conversations above my head. And I could hear them enough to know they were human voices, or at least they sounded human, and they were conversing with each other, but I could not understand exactly what they were saying. And so then came the displaced weight, I should say, on our wooden floors. It was as if somebody with heavy boots was walking and would walk from the living room into the kitchen, then walk through the hallway up to my door every night. And it was pretty intense because you could hear it draw nearer and nearer to the door. And then once it got in front of my door, it would stop.
Mm.
So I saw shadow figures. There would be a smoky apparition that would just fill the room and then hover in the corner like a cloud.
Mm.
But more than anything else, I mean, I grew up in a Christian family.
Mm.
And I knew, even at that young age, that what I was being taught in Christianity and within the four walls of my Sunday school, none of it fit within the blueprint of what I was experiencing.
Mm.
And so that set me into the discipline of demonology. And, I tell people I'm a demonologist, but I'm not someone who throws holy water, not to discount that. But I'm very much scientific in the sense that I'm looking at the experiences, not through a dogmatic lens, but trying to understand what it is they were witnessing in antiquity and why it is that it matters today.
Yes. It is very interesting because it's one of those things that seems to have been with us since the birth of the written word, Nathan.
Oh, yeah.
Regardless of creeds and cultures from around the world, there has often been this or these creatures or entities or whatever you want to call them, whatever label you wish to brandish them with, across numerous continents and lifestyles, and regardless, there are classed as a demon or creatures of such name. Mm-hmm. And yet I found it very interesting that it, even when we've had one of the standard explanations, is this kind of cross-pollination of cultures absorbing other religions and cultures, Nathan, and taking on those ideas and bringing them forward. Yet in regards to this, they all seem rather similar. And yet here we are. And we still seem to have these predefined archaic concepts of what these entities actually are.
Yes, sir. Most especially in the discipline of demonology.
Mm.
Now, the modern demonologist does not exist.
Yes.
And that's not a disrespectful thing, and it may sound like it, but I'm just being truthful here.
Mm.
The modern demonologist no longer exists. Your most educated demonologists within academia are your Catholic exorcists.
Yes.
And yet they too are tethered to religious dogma, and they're limited.
Mm.
So, you're not going to have a Father Sinistrari here. You're not going to have a Montague Summers in modernity because the religious pop culture, they do not want an intelligent concept of demonology. They don't. They want entertainment, and they want someone to just come in here and get rid of it without someone who's an observer saying, hold up, let's look at the data sample. If this is a fallen angel, why is it biblically illiterate?
Yes.
See, these are the questions that would keep ancient demonologists up at night.
Yes.
These are the meaningful, the profundities that haunted their existences. That's what drove them into this field. And so if anything, I'm trying to revive the long forgotten voices of the past and say, hey, listen, they were wondering how these entities are manifesting. We're just trying to figure out if we can make money off of a TV show. There is a profound chasm here.
Yes.
And it has to be filled. And I'm not going to rant, but that's my two cents in that degree.
I mean, it is very interesting, and I've noticed this as someone that's had an interest in the paranormal and hauntings and spirits most of my life since I've been able to read, essentially. I've found it very peculiar the way that this concept of demons and demonology over the last 20 years seems to have both come to the fore and yet still been extremely old-fashioned, Nathan. It's as if we have this one-size-fits-all template that
yes, sir,
doesn't change, doesn't adapt to the scenarios and continually refers to, as you touched on earlier on, a dogmatic lens to view this kind of situation, regardless of who it affects and how it affects them.
Correct. And the sad thing is these entities have mutated. It's as if it's a disease. These entities have mutated. They mutated in the first century. They mutated in biblical antiquity. They even mutated in the 12th century in the way that they would manifest as incubi.
Yes.
You know, the plural for incubus. So if they're mutating and their victimology and pathology is mutating and demonology is sitting here fiddling with their thumbs thinking, man, if I get one more TV show, I may make an extra paycheck. We have completely missed this discipline.
Hmm.
And I'm disappointed not just in the popularity contest, the pomp and circumstance of it all.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, anybody can go out there and dress all in black and put a priestly collar on. Next thing you know, I'm a demonologist.
Yes.
And the sad thing is, I'm going to be very honest with you, these entities could take their lives at will.
Hmm.
And I'm not there as in these people, and I've ran into a couple of them. Thank God I don't associate with some of these people. Most of the demonologists I know are very good people and they know what they're doing.
Hmm.
But there are some people who just think that this is a curiosity and not a calling.
Yes.
And that could be a fatal fascination if they're not careful.
As you refer to Dr. Taff, he dealt with some extremely violent situations, regardless of what pigeonhole we wish to put
Correct.
That particular phenomenon in, Nathan.
Correct.
Which is one of the things why I've always appreciated his work and his tenacity and his scientific method, because once again, he was someone that, regardless of his experiments into precognition and remote viewing, he was very dubious about the use of psychics and the ability of so-called people to be able to channel and communicate with such things, because
Correct.
He didn't believe they were on the same level at all.
Right.
Even though he couldn't explain what it was or why it was,
right.
He found, and obviously he's also quite frustrated in this modern, you know, whistles and bells, pop culture
yes, sir.
Style of ghost hunting that we have now, because I'm always astounded that on certain shows, I'm amazed how many demons of Christian faith seem to exist in North America, Nathan.
Of course, right? They're all Beelzebub and Belial and all. Isn't it interesting that 90% of your demons are Catholic?
Yes. Yes.
That is a sad case.
Absolutely.
Of peasantry.
Absolutely. I mean, did they come across on the Mayflower as well, or,
Exactly right. They all know Latin. I mean, they must have been converted in one portion of history, or...
Yes.
See, that's what led me into this and really drew a line in the sand for me.
Mm.
Because what... And here's my... Just to put this out there, I do not believe that demons are fallen angels.
Mm.
The fallen angel theory comes from biblical illiteracy. It's not there. We can get in that in a second if you want to. But what I realized is that we're not interpreting, as demonologists, we're not interpreting the data sample as it should be. We're not even being honest with it. Because the demons that people are casting out, especially in the Catholic Rite, they're human beings.
Mm.
I mean, even if you look at the holy water exorcistic rite, throwing holy water, that comes out of the book of Numbers chapter 16.
Mm.
That's not a ritual meant for fallen angels. It was a ritual meant for priests who had touched a dead body. And literally in Hebrew, it's called corpse pollution.
Yes.
So that should be the first sign. Okay, why is the ritual working?
Yep.
Who are we cleansing and what defiled them? Here's what defiled them. They have an unclean, deceased person in them.
Mm.
And so the Catholic exorcistic rites, they have hung their hat on the rate of their successes and not on the reasons for it.
Mm.
It works because the entity knows what is going on.
Mm.
The priest might not be aware of it.
Yeah.
And so what I look in terms of demonology, I approach it as an understanding of the afterlife. It's afterlife phenomenon. It's not new life discovered. It's old life discovered in a new way.
Mm. I mean, I've often found that the concept and the explanation, as you touched on there, Nathan, of fallen angels, when you actually put that under scrutiny, it seems to fall apart very quickly, because, as you say, these creatures seem to be quite ignorant when it comes to the words of the Bible or the Torah or the Quran. They don't seem to have that knowledge, and that, regardless of which religious denomination you believe in and whichever, you know, whichever faith is your strength, mm-hmm. I've often found that quite a difficult concept to grasp, that if these are creatures, regardless of their explanations, they seem to know next to nothing, and yet they're supposed to be enshrined in whichever religious text they come from.
Exactly right. Exactly right. When that revelation came to the fore in my life, I threw all of my inherited dogma away. I threw all of my demonology from Christianity away, and I had to start over again. And you're right. And what I come to the conclusion of, and this is fascinating, that when we go into hauntings and when we go into possessing cases, we are witnessing memory in motion. Hmm. We are confronting a form. And I know I'm going to teach here in alliterations, and I used to hate them, but people remember them more than other things. So please, yes. If it gets verbose, just yell at me. But we're confronting consciousness. Hmm. And one of my favorite authors, she's not an author, she's an academic, Janice Bodie from the University of British Columbia, she defines possession as the merging of energy and matter.
Yes.
And so when we are encountering demoniacs, quote unquote demoniacs, we have to understand that the possessing entity is working off of its own belief system and its own memory. That's why it may be ignorant in some portions of history. It may not know philosophy. It may not know anything about the Enlightenment period, but it will know about the microcosm of time it existed in. Mm. And I first realized that by going through what's called the Age of the Demoniac in the 16th century.
Yes.
And researching the – it's called the D-Book. People call it the Dybbuk. And I'm not Fraser Crane here. I'm not going to stress the importance of how to say a word.
Yes.
But, you know, D-Book. But, you know, that was definitely 100% afterlife phenomenon. Mm. It's the Kabbalistics the Kabbalistic exorcists, rather – they were casting out people who were formerly embodied, who had their own belief systems, and in many cases, they didn't even believe in Yahweh, but they had a belief in Allah.
Mm.
As 1999 in Baghdad, we had a possession case where the rabbi was trying to cast this spirit out of a man and said, you know what, it's not working. He went over to the city next door and said, okay, give me an imam. The imam came over, hit him in the head with the hadith, quoted some rites from the Islamic tradition, and the entity left. See, and I'm not going to ramble, but I want to finish this point with this. We don't even know what they have faith in yet, because we don't even know what they have a fear of.
Mm. I've come across that a couple of times in certain cases. That one of the most famous ones that springs to my mind straight away, Nathan, is the infamous Humpty Doo poltergeist in Australia. Mm. And they ended up getting, I think they had three different priests of various strands of Christianity to come.
Right.
And none of them were able to deal with it. And once again, that's working on the principle of, well, whatever this entity is, it must be Christian in faith, even though mm-hmm. they're in an area that Christianity has only probably existed for the better part of 250 years as a belief system with immigration.
Correct.
And I found it very peculiar that they didn't consider the concept that it may have been native. Whatever it was, why did it, you know, once again, as we've mentioned, it always seems to be, it has to fall back into Christianity constantly, regardless. And I find that quite both perplexing and frustrating.
It is. It's a damning aspect to this field. It's like I say, you know, if you put an imam, a priest and a rabbi in one room and said, listen, you guys have 3 hours to figure out what a demon is. Within 5 minutes, they'll all come out shouting at each other and claiming religious supremacy. Right? And if that's true, then we have three different gods that these entities rebelled against. We have three different heavens that they fell from. And we have three different religious rites that they obey. Now, anybody with half a brain would say that just doesn't work.
Mm.
Well, I mean, you know, in the Judaism, they have what are called the Shin Dalit.
Yep.
The Shin Dalit are supposed to be entities that are half human because God was creating them. Then the Sabbath came and he said, you know what, to heck with you guys. You're going to be half created. And now they roam the earth as half humans, right? What you're going to see there when you interpret all of these religious rites and traditions, you're going to see that they all have a common thematic element, and that is that they're trying to interpret afterlife phenomenon, and they're trying to deify it. So, you know, those are primarily the possessing entities that are formerly human. According to the 16th century Kabbalists, these entities, these people rather, would possess individuals sometimes for them to say, you know what, I'm here because I want you to bury my body. Here's where my body's located. Just give me a proper burial and I'm out. And they would do that. Other times it would be quite literally, this is the person who stabbed me. Here's the murder weapon. This is his address. Go and find him. They went and found the person and, you know, and the perpetrator, and they arrested him. He starts freaking out and confesses. How did you know it? You know, a fallen angel's not going to tell on a murderer. I mean, it just falls apart. But in addition to that, there is a second species of a formerly human entity that does operate within this dimension. And it is the most chilling creature that I've ever encountered, both in possession cases and in my research. And this is primarily what I'm pushing for in terms of the end of the year. They're serial killers.
Do you mean in regards to the urge to kill or the urge to control?
Yes, sir. So the second species of possessing entities, they are not transient. They do not really pick people out of a crowd. They do not get easily offended. If you go into a house that you shouldn't be in, they'll leave you alone. They don't care. What they're after is they're after creating what the ancients would call an external soul. An external soul is something we would just call it a body.
Yes.
They call it an external soul. And so when I first encountered these entities, it was in cases like Dr. Barry Taft's case, and just studying the pathology and victimology here. Oh, my God. It's terrifying in the sense that demonology is so far behind where these entities are. It's quite intimidating.
It's almost as if they require a physical tether to enable them to enact or sort of deal with their thirst for whatever reason that they need it, Nathan.
Correct. And the earliest pictorial tradition I have found of true possession phenomenon is it goes way beyond the first century. It goes beyond the late Iron Age. It's what's called the Katamua inscription. And in 2008, the University of Chicago sent out archaeologists to Turkey. They went on what's called the Zincirli expedition. And during this expedition, they unearthed what's called the Katamua sarcophagus. Katamua was a Turkish official. And anyways, in this sarcophagus, Katamua, he says this. He wrote in the Aramaic language. He said, "I, Katamua, before I died, I went out and paid an artificer of metal to create for me a stele." Stele is basically a metal coffin. And he said that my soul, now this is incredible, this is long before any Catholic ever even understood demonology, even before the first century Jesus existed, anything. He says that my soul is in the stele. And in addition to that, when you discover my sarcophagus, my coffin, I want you to bring me blood sacrifices. Now, that is the earliest understanding of consciousness possessing something. Was not a fallen angel. It was afterlife phenomenon. Since then, these entities, these serial killer entities, have been using our ignorance against us and trying to create a second self of existence. They're no longer trying to place their souls into metal sarcophagi, in Genesis 6, they're trying to create a new species of human. So where the babies that were born, are you familiar with the Genesis 6 narrative at all?
Yes, yes.
Okay. What they did, it wasn't, you know, because I grew up in Christianity, so I heard about it my whole life, and I thought, okay, it's a wrap, I've got it all taken care of.
Yeah.
No, because what they did in Genesis 6, according to the Apocryphon of John, and let me back up and say this, the Apocryphon of John is a Coptic manuscript preserved by Egyptian monks between the 2nd and 4th centuries. Mm. Let's see if what this author says mirrors in any way what an incubus is.
Yeah.
The Apocryphon of John, it says that these entities did not take wives unto themselves in terms of marriage. It says that they first appear to, quote, wives in the image of their husbands, and then they coerce them into intercourse. And at the moment of conception, let's make it PG, at the moment of conception,
yes,
they stared into the eyes of these women and then instantaneously reversed their apparition to their original appearance.
Mm.
Now, to a modern demonologist, we would high-five each other and say, see, we got a bunch of EVPs, we're good to go. That's not what they're doing.
Yeah.
That was what that tradition of staring into the face was an ancient obstetric. Obstetric is a reference to gynecology and fertility.
Mm.
It's an ancient obstetric rite that whatever the woman is focused upon, at the moment of conception, she will be impregnated with the image of. So the children that were birthed in that part of history, in Genesis 6, they were designed to look like the apparition that they had encountered in bed.
Mm. So it's almost as if it's both a spiritual and a physical imprint.
Yes, sir.
That then becomes created by the utilization of both a spiritual and a physical connection at that point of inception.
Correct. Now, when we get into the term Nephilim, we have to remember that at the time that text was written, there were no vowels in the Hebrew language.
Mm.
So the original Hebrew word, without the vowels, it means one of two things or two things at the same time. Now, this is fascinating.
Mm.
It means a stillbirth, or it means unexpected pregnancy.
Yes.
That's where they mutated again.
Mm.
So what were they doing? Well, here's what the Apocryphon of John says, that out of the darkness they begat children whose likenesses were their image, the father or the quote-unquote incubus, their images. What was the purpose? Well, we in order to understand why they would even want that, we have to go into possession phenomenon and ask ourselves, what is the mortal to that entity? Why is it wearing them like a garment? Like if you go into Fritz Kramer's work, The Red Fez, he goes to Haiti.
Yeah.
And he's led by the hand by one of his guides. And he goes into this circle of fire and he sees this man chanting and dancing. And the man, he's Haitian. So he is a person of color. But his body has been scarred and marred to the point that it no longer looks like a human being. Like, you can't recognize him as a man or a woman.
Mm.
And so he asks his guide, he said, what in the world is going on here? You know, not to be disrespectful, but why is he so scarred?
Mm.
And the guide said, well, he said, the entity, when the ancestor possesses him, each time he is possessed by that ancestor, he will carve his flesh and take rocks and scar his flesh into the image of that ancestor. Now, that's when Fritz Kramer said that possession is when they wear us as their social skin.
Mm.
That's why they did what they did in Genesis 6.
Mm. So it's almost as if they're hiding in plain sight.
Yes, yes. We are used to men looking like monsters. We're not used to monsters looking like men.
Very true. In regards to that, Nathan, I've always been interested to obviously, because when you mentioned the incubi and incubus, mm-hmm. obviously people will often refer to the succubuses as well. So has right. that concept been there as long, or was that a more modern invention that was sort of added on to kind of switch it up, or have they worked in parallel?
Here's the truth of the matter. We do not know if the incubus and succubus spirits are one and the same and they're manifesting differently,
mm.
or if they're working with each other.
Mm.
Now, if you really want to dig into this deeper, I will go ahead and quote Father Sinistrari of Amino.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Franciscan priest, and he wrote a beautiful book on the incubus and succubus. But he had cases where he would land in the bedroom with his tools, with his data collecting tools and everything, but he would land within the case, within the home, within an hour of that entity being there, and he would collect semen samples, mm. sperm samples, tangible substances left in the womb and on the bed.
Yes.
Now, let's look at this. Are they spiritual? If they are spiritual, are they excreting something, or are they taking it from someone else and transporting it to their victim?
Mm.
I, along with other anesthesiologists, we all believe the same thing. We do not believe they're excreting it. We believe that they're milking the carcasses of the recently deceased,
mm.
and they're taking it and trying to implant it. Hello, UFO abduction phenomenon. Implant it. I'm telling you, there's a lot of people out there, ufology, they frown at me because I'm a demonologist, and it's like, listen, if you don't know history, you will never understand the future.
Yes.
So that's what they've been doing. So Sinistrari believed that too. Montague Summers was a proponent to that theory as well. Here is why.
Mm.
The semen samples that they were collecting were old.
Mm.
It was as if they were going, and in many cases they've been witnessed as vampires doing this. They would go into graveyards, dig up the body, reanimate the organ,
mm.
take what they needed, either give it to a succubus or give it to an incubus, however they work, and then go and try to use a dream state existence, a world where literally people will be asleep, they think it's a dream, they wake up and it's not.
Mm.
And then they would use that as a means of consent to impregnate.
Mm.
They've been doing this for millennia.
Would this create a kind of hierarchy, Nathan? Because surely if we have this kind of concept of whatever these entities are, one would presume that as we see in man, not all are created equal. So would this kind of hierarchical, one would call civilization, do they have this kind of concept of that, or is it simply that everything is on an even keel and they are all of the same level?
I think the answer to that question has to be understood in this framework. The earliest entities to have done this were called Malachim and Rephaim.
Mm.
That's what they were called throughout the ancient Mediterranean world, in the Semitic traditions, the Ugaritic, the Akkadian, Phoenician, Hebrew. So they were called the Rephaim, their deceased ancestors. The Malachim is where people get mixed up with fallen angels.
Yes.
That word Malachim is not angels. In comparative etymology, it's literally deceased ancestors again. It's deceased kings. So to answer your question, if there is an hierarchical, patriarchal, or any kind of systematic authority there, it would have to be based upon who did this first. And I'll tell you why I say that, not just because of comparative etymology, but it seems as if there are people who live and die and they're being educated into that religious body.
Mm.
They're learning how to adapt into that ancient world.
Mm.
And I've seen it in possession cases, because we have possession cases where they'll say, you know what, give me a blood sacrifice. The moment – and I'm not going to ramble, but I have to say this. I'm getting passionate. The moment – we hear an entity request a blood ritual, right there, what we're learning is that that entity is being bred He's being indoctrinated with the system, and he's learning what to value in that dimension. And it's different. It's not somebody who says, listen, I need to be buried, right?
Yeah.
This entity's systematic, he's predatory, and he has a serial killer pathology. It's a whole different ballgame, and that's why it's so dangerous when people think, you know what, I'll splash some clone on me, get me a preach the collar, read a couple books, I got me holy water, so let's go to war. No, they'll snatch your consciousness and wear you as skin, and you won't know it.
I mean, yeah, that is the obviously the abstract that you could take from that in regards to the not that I want to use the term ignorance, but there does seem to be an arrogance sometimes, Nathan, when people try to deal with this kind of thing, that they presume that whatever they know has the strength or the will to be able to break whatever they're trying to deal with. And I've often been fascinated when we've often heard accounts of exorcisms that have gone wrong for whatever reason or gone too far. Across all cultures throughout history, there are terrifying tales. There is a tale from near where I grew up of a gentleman who clearly was suffering from some kind of mental illness, and the exorcism tipped him over the edge, and it's a horrific murder case.
Oh my god,
one of the most violent cases you could ever wish to meet. It's known as the Michael Taylor case in UK. He's nicknamed the Demoniac, essentially because it's one of those cases that seems to have been misinterpreted and misused to further certain ideas and belief systems, Nathan.
Right. But
when you look at it, like I say, it's one of those stories that I didn't know about it until I was 16, even though the events happened in the locality that surrounded where I grew up.
Right. Okay.
So it's one of those things that I've often had an interest in, and obviously, you know, pop culture will always reference certain aspects and frame our knowledge of how we expect these circumstances. And so for me, I've often been intrigued more than anything, Nathan, about how are people chosen? How do people find themselves in a situation where these entities, these concepts decide or view them as a victim?
Okay, the answer to that question is, it gets kind of complicated, but I'm going to simplify it as best as I can. What we are witnessing here, at least with the lower level possessing entities that are possessing people in a transient way, is a form of education. And so it's like they're learning how to drive a car.
Yes.
And if you go back to Genesis 6, the second degree, the PhDs, the hooded ones, or what I call the molters, are those who have already been indoctrinated. They've already know how to possess. They've been transient. They've matured and evolved to the point where I know how to do all that stuff. Now I'm trying to recreate another me. So to answer that question, just like in Genesis 6, where they would biologically design a new body for themselves and place their soul in it, they are grooming people in one way of educating their young. They're grooming people to be serial killers, not just biologically, but emotionally. And once they've got that individual to a degree of control, they will step into that individual, just like possession. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let's go to why it is that I believe they think like serial killers. Jeffrey Dahmer's favorite movie was The Exorcist.
Yes.
Now, you remember how I told you that possession is memory and motion?
Yes.
Okay, now watch this. This is crazy, man. Jeffrey Dahmer's only living victim was a male, and Jeffrey Dahmer tried to drug him with beer, I think it was, or liquor, one of the two. And the man went into the restroom and didn't drink any of it, came back outside, and when he came back out into the living room, he turned to see Jeffrey Dahmer sitting on the couch, swaying back and forth. He was in a trance, and he was speaking an unknown language. Whose language was he speaking? Who was operating his tongue? Was it Jeffrey? That's case number one. Case number two, Jeffrey Dahmer was known. He did this often. He would crush the bones of his victims, pulverize them into powder and go into his backyard and in a fanning motion, sprinkle them, fan them all over his lawn. That's a necromantic rite. But how did he know that?
Yeah.
See, whose memory is in motion during these cases here? So that's one aspect of it. I can go into the BTK killer, but essentially there is an indoctrination program that they are using us to teach their young and those who are new in that dimension. We see it as possession. They see it as an educational system, and we keep kicking them out of people, not realizing what in the heck is going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the thing as well, because it seems as dangerous to simply try and deal with these situations and not be prepared for the ramifications, because it seems as if you're basically putting a sticking plaster on a broken leg, Nathan, because essentially you're just bumping it somewhere else, are you not?
Yeah, we're creating repeat offenders.
Mm.
And I think that there's a mass assumption here that has to be addressed. Just because it leaves the victim doesn't mean it was banished.
Mm.
So, you know, and I think that there are many cases where that has happened, don't get me wrong, but I think that just, you know, systematic demonology has limited us to dogma in the sense that we have believed that every entity is a fallen angel.
Yes.
And so if we treat them like that and their true request is, listen, I just want my body to be buried, then we've created a repeat offender. And so Sally may have been delivered, but Sarah down the street's about to be possessed, correct?
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole discipline of demonology is about to be turned on its head, because we're not dealing with just entities that have religious systems that are operating off of their memory. We're dealing with entities that are being indoctrinated into a new belief system, a new currency value. And if we're not understanding that, then it's going to mutate without our awareness. And at that point, one day it will look us right in the eye. We'll shake hands with it, and then it'll have its way.
Because I've often been this story seems to come around every 3 or 4 years, I've noticed, Nathan, that the Catholic Church will say, we're recruiting exorcists because demons are on the rise everywhere. Mm-hmm. Everywhere you look, like in American paranormal television, demons are everywhere. And,
right.
And I've often thought, surely there must be a finite number. Unless we're overrun, right. Because otherwise they'd be, you know, with the greatest respect, they would be everywhere if they are based in this religious framework.
Correct.
Whereas the concept of it being repeat offenders, if we are to accept that, seems a far more logical explanation than the fact that we are being overrun. Because surely, if we work on the concept of it being a short-term release or a moving on to the next soul or tether, as it were. That, for me, in the concept of possession, would make more sense than it being, essentially, would call an army, because it would be
exactly
a ridiculous amount, and it would be a consistent battle. And that, you know, and I don't mean that disrespectfully to anybody's religious choices, but I've often thought it has to be one or the other, and neither the twain should mix, really.
Correct. Non-overlapping magisteria. I think that you're correct, and that is another aspect where religious dogma has just limited this field. It's not fallen angels in the sense of angels that lost their wings. We're dealing with deified ancestors who, when they died, they were called the Rephaim. It goes all the way back into the late Iron Age. The Rephaiumi is mentioned. They're deceased ancestors. And so what we have to remember is this, and this is not Nathaniel saying this, this is history. When we encounter someone who was formerly human, they will have aspects of them that are human, but they will have other aspects of themselves that have transitioned and molted their body. And so when we have cases like the Parent case in Harrisville, Rhode Island, and you have what seem to be human spirits, absolutely, in the house, and when Ed Lorraine Warren went in and did that seance, there was a second dimension and level of entity that walked in that room, and it pushed all of the other spirits back. That was a person who was formerly human, but he's a soul hunter.
Mm.
Now, this gets deep. Soul hunters are exactly what we're talking about. They are the people who are trying to recreate a second self.
Yeah.
They're the serial killer entity. They will victimize us just like a serial killer will, and they have evolved alongside of us. Now, your serial killers are mentioned in the ancient Mediterranean texts. Mm. Your serial killer entities were mentioned in Ezekiel 13. Yahweh called them soul hunters.
Mm.
Now, this is going to be incredible. Do we still have time?
Absolutely. Carry on, my friend.
Okay. Is this interesting? Oh, I hope it is.
Very much so.
Okay, so Yahweh called them soul hunters in Ezekiel 13. Now, let's look at the victimology of these soul hunters here.
Hmm.
Number one, they go into homes at nighttime. Check.
Mm-hmm.
They go into homes, they go to their victims while they're sleeping or while they're awake, and they put them to sleep.
Hmm.
Then they will wait until what's called their Ba'ah soul. It's a reference to the Egyptian tradition that when a person dies, their soul flies out of their body like a bird.
Mm.
They'll wait until that soul separates from their body. Mm. They'll take that soul, the actual spirit. Then they will cut a piece of the flesh off of their victim and sew it onto themselves to create a social skin. This is in Ezekiel 13.
Mm.
Now, if you want to see where that's mirrored in serial killer pathology or even anything remotely close to it, go look at the Beast of Jersey.
Mm.
Go look at Ed Gein.
Yeah.
Go look at why these entities, for one reason or another, there has to be a unification of being here.
Mm.
And so these entities, as far back as biblical antiquity, they were wearing skin from their victims in order to look human again.
Mm.
That's how sick these entities are. We're not talking about the transient, and forgive this term, but low life, uneducated, illiterate, who just picks somebody from a crowd and says, "Hey guys, listen, I'm here to make everybody angry."
Mm.
Right? He doesn't even know what to request yet.
Mm.
We're dealing with someone that knows enough about whatever dimension he's in to victimize us. Now, let's go to UFO abduction.
Mm.
UFO abduction, usually they put us to sleep. They put us into a trance. We're taken into a metallic room or somewhere, and they take what from us? Just like an incubus would. They take sperm. What does a succubus do? Take sperm. An incubus, all of us. They're doing fertility rites.
Mm.
What are they creating? You know, David Jacobs and all these ufologists, and I respect them highly, but I do not at all believe that these are extraterrestrials. I think they're interterrestrial. I think that these are disincarnate necromancers.
Mm. Well, it is often the concept of when you go into the realms of high strangeness, Nathan, is one man's alien another man's demon.
Yes, it should be. It should be, because every demon was alien to the experiencer.
Mm. And is it a case of the vessel that is being used? It all depends on their comprehension of the scenario and how they reflect the expectation of how they should appear based on that person's fear.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. They've used our fear as their form.
Mm.
Now, let's dig deeper to this if we can. You remember how I told you that Genesis 6, that's how they victimize these wives, they appear to them as their husbands?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dr. Carla Turner, one of the great UFO abduction researchers, rest her soul, she wrote a book called The Masquerade of Angels. Sounds like Genesis 6 already.
Yes.
And in it, she details different cases of abductees. Number one, it was a gentleman by the name of Ted Rice. Ted Rice said he was abducted at the age of 6 along with his grandmother.
Hmm.
Now, let's look at the victimology. The grandmother is sitting on a table in the ship, and a hybrid being walks up to her and tries to get her into intercourse. Check. Sounds like Genesis 6. Sounds like an incubus. And then she says something that's very interesting to me. She says, I've only known one man my entire life, and that was my husband, and he is deceased. Genesis 6. Instantaneously, here comes the apparition of her husband. Now, here's what I'm thinking. Maybe I'm crazy. Hopefully not, but I guarantee you, if that woman would have had intercourse with that entity would have done what they've been doing for thousands of years. It would have maintained the appearance of her husband until the moment of conception. Then what would it do? It would change instantaneously and stare into her eyes.
Mm.
He's already there. He's 75% there. Yeah. So they're doing the same thing in many ways. They're playing a different game, and if they're playing a different game, then we have to understand the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And clearly the rules are not what we are told or expected to believe.
No, not at all. And parapsychology, as gifted as they are, and they're all of my heroes, but just because you know the dimensionality of a chessboard does not mean you know the rules of the game.
Very true. I mean, in your personal and professional experience so far, Nathan, how does one assist someone who is waylaid by this situation or fighting off this kind of affliction, as we could call it? How can you support and help someone in a situation where they feel that they are being drained for whatever reason?
Well, in Ezekiel 13, the act of taking flesh off of another human being and placing it on yourself, it's a reference back to the Old Testament. It was a reference to a physician who would attach skin and graft it over a wound. There's a reason why these entities use attachments as a grooming mechanism.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
It's spiritual and physical here. It's fascinating, man. Oh, my God. So, you know, that's how they begin. So when I deal with someone with attachment, it's different versus how I deal with someone with possession. If I deal with someone with attachment, I'm looking for scarification. Mm. Have you tried to kill yourself yet? There was a woman, I was sitting down one night, I was smoking a cigar at a restaurant in the patio and reading one of my authors, my current authors. My friend brought a lady to me, this young girl, and he said, you know, he said, I know what you do, and she seems like she needs some help here, and she wants to talk to you. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, I'm on my downtime. I don't want to deal. Honestly, I'm like, you know what? I've done a lot of cases. I don't want to deal with anybody. I just want to smoke my Cohiba and whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, she sits down, and she tells me a story. She says, my best friend needs your help. I said, okay, what happened? She says, well, my best friend lost her grandfather the other day. Her grandfather lives in an old house. She said that he was being chased out of a house, her house, by a demon. And it chased him into the yard, and they watched. They could see the entity. And the grandfather died right there on the lawn. He had a heart attack because of the event and died. And she said, now my best friend does not want to go back into that house, and who could blame her?
Yeah.
Now, This is very – because I'm going to answer your question, but I have to demonstrate it first.
Right.
While I'm talking to her, I see this black cloud. It's like a blanket.
Mm.
Just literally lay over top of this girl that I'm talking to. It hugged her almost.
Yes.
That's an attachment. That is the grooming mechanism. That's the stage in which this entity is conforming itself to the victim.
Mm.
See, possession is when it conforms you to it.
Yes.
So the best way I dealt with this entity is I saw it for what it was, and it was suicide.
Mm.
And I asked her, I said, okay, you know, I said, before we get into all of this, I said, there's an attachment of suicide. When I said that, the atmosphere changed. She began to cry.
Mm.
She held her hand out, put my finger on her wrist, and I felt the scarification of this entity. She said, I slit my wrist, and I almost died a year ago. That's the attachment.
Yeah.
Now let's look at how this entity had manipulated her. I said, okay, this entity that I'm feeling is familial. Who in your family has committed suicide? She said, my grandfather killed himself in 2014. Now, that entity had manipulated her consciousness to the point that she didn't even know how to cry for help.
Yeah.
There was a young girl there that needed help. It was her. There was a grandfather present that died.
It was
him. It was him.
Yeah.
So her silent screaming had pushed her in my direction. What did I do? Well, with the attachment, I begin to give them their consent back. And I tell them that the emotions that you're feeling and that you're following, they're not yours. Because that's when that entity's laying itself over them. By the time, and I had a murder case where actual possession took place, but by the time you're possessed, you've already given consent to that stage. It's already conformed itself to you. Now, for all the listeners not going to listen to this podcast, go look up on Google, look up the picture of a Dybbuk or a Dybbuk.
Yeah.
You'll see it's an old man. He has a skeleton, and on the skeleton, there is a black cloak on him. It's laying on that human embodied person. Why? Because that entity is disincarnate. That is an attachment. The word Dybbuk has two meanings in Hebrew. Number one, it means possession. Number two, it means to cling. So that's how I deal with it. Now, with possession, it's different because that entity is present for a reason. It wastes no time.
Yeah.
Now, it's not just I'm in skin. Why are you here? Because the murder case that I had, it had manipulated a 13-year-old girl into trying to kill her parents. And it had possessed her enough to get her to open the door, and it had possessed her friend enough to do the killing. You know, it couldn't. It's weird. It's weird. So there's a measure of consent here, and there are different rights that I can employ in possession cases. But it's better to prevent than it is to intervene.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting as well. There seems to be some very interesting parallels, Nathan, with vampiric lore. Because
it is.
It's often a returning familiar person. There's often a build-up. It gets to its inevitable point. There is the constant weakening of a person's fight or ability to defend themselves.
Yes.
And yet there is often the parameters that the victim is often not believed or dismissed. Through either grief, especially if it's a loved one that they're claiming to have visited them. And yet, when we look at the modern concept of the demon, essentially they are very similar bedfellows.
They are. Yes, they are. Now, this is interesting too. This is fascinating. Yahweh makes a very interesting reference in Ezekiel 13. He says that, okay, they're necromancers through and through. In addition to that, Yahweh says that those who should die live, and those who should live die. See, I never understood the end game. I couldn't understand it. Why are they creating a second self? Why did Kadamua want metal to possess? Right? What was this all about? It's afterlife phenomenon. But what is the external soul? Because in Ezekiel 13, that's what they're accused of creating. They would take things from their victims, put them down to nothingness, to where they're asleep, and then kill them, and then take pieces of their flesh and add it to their own. Which means two things. Number one, these necromancers are physical entities. And that when we go into homes and we smell rotting or decomposing organic matter, what are we smelling? Literally, dead flesh. That's why. Now, they can be invisible. That's another thing. That's another thing in Ezekiel 13. They have what the Bible calls cloaks of invisibility. Okay, so moving forward, this external soul idea, I didn't understand what the end game was. I knew they were playing a different game because I knew they were playing by different rules. But what was an external soul? Why do they want it so badly? Well, I got a book by the anthropologist James Frazier. It's called The Golden Bough. And in it, he talks about the ancient understanding of an external soul. Literally, it's a body. And it said that when warriors were in battle, and if, and when they knew that death was impending, they would dispossess... There we go. He's not even a demonologist, right? They would dispossess their own body and place their soul, hello, Katamua, in another body. It was an act of self-preservation. They didn't want to die. What does that mean that they're doing? They're creating, in the Apocrypha of John, it says that they were creating copies of the same body.
Yeah.
So in UFO abduction phenomenon, we can have 1,000 different grades, and be, they're being operated by one consciousness. You can kill one, and you haven't even touched the true possessing entity. Now, that's a theory I'm going to throw out there, because that right there is – sounds like a Stephen King novel, but it's true.
Yes.
It's, you know, it's happening, at least in according to my research.
Well, and often has parallels in obviously, I Am Legion.
Yes. That was a necromancer, by the way.
Very true. In your work, in your experience, Nathan, have you come across the same entity more than once?
I have. I had a haunting. It was it's actually, I call it the haunting on Church Street, as ironic as that is.
That's where I grew up, on a haunted house.
Yeah, there we go. That's it. Wow, that's, talk about synchronicity, huh?
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the murder case I had. But yeah, so that entity, I cleansed the house, and in the cleansing, we could see the darkness leave. Like it was like somebody slowly turned the light on, and you could see shadows moving out of the house up above the wall. It was just crazy. The entire house changed. It's about a month later that I got a phone call from a friend saying, hey, listen, I got a case. I'm like, okay, what's the address? It's like, it's right here. And I look at the map, and it's like one block away from the house I was just at. And it was that was an incubus case. So I do believe that was the same entity.
Yeah.
100%. You know, so I do believe that's the case. But see, with systematic demonology, we're trying to describe manifestations and then define manifestations by our descriptions. You know, what if these are the same entities and they're just manifesting in different ways according to their value?
Yeah, but yes, exactly. I was about to say it's a many-faceted situation, Nathan.
Yes, sir.
Is it something that still surprises you? Because I often think that probably the biggest mistake anybody can make, especially when we're dealing with such scenarios as these, is to be under the misapprehension that you've learnt everything you need to know.
Oh, God. I'm the least of my brethren.
Yes.
I'm not lying. I mean, I my heroes are T. Witten Davies, Montague Summers. I mean, the literature that I read and the demonology that I have just entrenched myself into, these guys are transcendent. I mean, they are luminaries. There's it's hard for me to be dogmatic, even with my own belief systems, when I'm constantly meeting new theories and new, I don't know, dogmas, I guess. But I don't want to limit myself to them. I want to outgrow it, because I think that they're outgrowing us. And so we have to evolve according to the data.
Yes.
And I certainly don't know everything. I'm still learning myself. And to answer that question, I guess specifically, because I know I can go many places with this. Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of my greatest heroes, they asked him, before he died, they said, you know, how do you stay passionate about this? And he says, well, he goes, I'm always surprised.
Yes.
And I am, you know, so that's what keeps me fresh.
I mean, is it something, Nathan, that if you could look back at yourself as a child when you stumbled across that spirit all those years ago, are you glad to have found this calling? Do you think it's, I know some people smirk at the term destiny, or do you feel that this was something that was always going to happen? It, regardless of what you did with your life, this would always come to you.
I think that I was destined to this, but I think that if I had not went through that haunting as a young person, that when this calling would have manifested to me later on, I would have not had the immunity and insight into this that I would have gotten. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
Because it would have manifested to me as feelings and as assaults and hauntings, and yet I would have not had the tools to say, hey, listen, this is how you cope with it. So I had to go through it to grow into it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's clearly that experience gave you that grounding, as you say, to give you the knowledge and the tools to be able to adapt and educate yourself and constantly keep moving forwards.
I had to. The only way I could have existed in that house along with it is to, I literally did this many times. I would take what I was feeling, the fear that it was projecting, and I would ask myself, is this fear because I'm afraid, or is it projecting fear? Is this a language that is being communicated to me and I'm not old enough yet to understand it?
Yeah.
That's how I was able to cope with it. There's a lot of psychology involved here, especially if this is afterlife phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, it's all about the conception of allowing yourself to be able to deal with it, because if you just allow it, it can be overwhelming, Nathan.
Yes, sir. Yeah. That's why I listen to jazz, watch Frasier, and smoke cigars.
You know, well, exactly. Well, exactly. I mean, even demonologists need some downtime, sir.
Oh, my God. That's the truth, brother. That's the truth. But, yeah, man, you got to keep yourself, you know, and there are times when I don't do cases. I haven't done a case in a while because I'm writing my book. And, you know, you got to take care of yourself, because these entities, when you're just being around them, just around something that is preternatural, it will eclipse you.
Yeah.
And you have to make sure that you're staying close to your calling.
Yeah. Yes. You've got to look after yourself and make sure, essentially, to be as mentally and physically strong as you need to be. So you have to make sure that you're not drained, I would imagine.
Yeah. Correct. Correct. You know, when you look, like Nietzsche said, when you look enough into the darkness, it'll turn around and look back at you. I know I just killed that quote, but that's pretty much what he said. And that's really what it is. I mean, you know, it's just like you look into the darkness, hoping that your eyes adjust. And then as soon as they do, you realize, man, I didn't want to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, as the phrase goes, be careful what you wish for, I suppose.
Exactly right. But, you know, the field of demonology in the 21st century, I think it's going to outgrow some dogmas and grow into some new insights. I hope so.
Yeah, yes, me too. Nathan, frankly, it's been both fascinating and terrifying talking to you, and I'm delighted to have made your acquaintance.
Thank you.
So where can everybody keep up to date with your work and anything that you're up to coming forwards?
Okay, well, my website is njgillis.com. It's G-I-L-L-I-S. On there, I have all of my past interviews for this year and some upcoming interviews next month and the end of the year. Next year's conferences are already up. I'm still getting booked for more, so, you know, keep looking out for me. But that's my website. My Instagram and my Facebook, it's The Nathaniel J. Gillis. So yeah, you know, if you want more interviews of mine, hop on YouTube. I'm in a lot of places on there. So, but my book is going to be out at the end of the year. I'm shooting for October, and it's going to be called The Skin That Crawls. And I'm going to be introducing everybody to what I have termed the molter, who will wear us and then shed us like skin. That's what we're dealing with, Bob. It's worse than anything, but there are tools to deal with it. But yeah, that's my information.
Fantastic. I don't know whether I should read that book now after this conversation, but I will endeavor to take a deep breath and dive into it, and I wish you the very best of luck when it's released.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it very much.
Nathan, thank you for your time, and we will see you again.
Thank you, sir. Looking forward to it.